Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Castorbis Podcast with a K, available on Castorbis.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. Ladies and gentlemen, it's this week's Castorbis Podcast with a K. My name's Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Castorbis.com, and with me are James McLean and Brian Terranova. It's podcast time again, guys. We've got lots of thoughts of who to talk about, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I believe.
That's the idea of the podcast.
It is indeed the idea
of the
podcast.
It's what we do.
That is what we do. And greetings to any new listeners this week. We're still doing quite well with our listenership, chaps. You'll be glad to know. We haven't hit the heady heights of over 10,000 again, though. But then again, that was that would just be silly if we did that repeatedly, wouldn't it? I think. Nice, but somewhat silly. Perhaps for what we do. Anyway, last week, a website called Comic Book Movie published a list of episode synopses for Doctor Who Series 8. We think they're largely rubbish. Certainly, as far as Episode 1 goes, you know, the filming slash completing Episode 1 at the moment. So that it seems unlikely that that's accurate. And now, if you are a spoiler phobe, you may want to fast forward 10 minutes or so away from this and, you know, generally avoid what we're going to talk about. If you're not spoiler phobic, or if you think, or if you agree with our original headline, enjoy a pinch of salt with your popcorn, may contain actual spoilers, unlikely though. You may not mind listening to the following. For instance, there is The Twelve Keepers, Episode 1, which is, you know, we've got several titles for Episode 1 doing the rounds at the moment, because we've also got the Nemesis of Neglect, which has roots in the Jack the Ripper mystery. And again, this is Jack the Ripper. The Doctor battles the clockwork droids in Victorian England, apparently, whilst also uncovering the truth behind Jack the Ripper. Meanwhile, Clara meets a very familiar face. Episode 2. On a scientific way station in the year 3056, Clara and the Doctor uncover a DNA experiment that's about to go very wrong. Episode 4, said to revolve around the assassination of JFK. 8.5, an Egyptian set episode called The Cult of Ra. Is it Ray or Ra? I've never known whether it's Ray or Ra.
Should be
Cult
Ra,
of
right?
Ra.
Is it Ra? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Episode 9.
Unless you're talking about the Frank Black album, which was a play on it.
Right, I see.
The Cult of Ray.
Right, I wasn't talking about that. Mm. Said to be a forest world, maybe the River Song episode. Number 10 is where it starts getting a bit interesting. The Doctor and Clara travel to Pompeii to try and solve the mystery of his latest incarnation. I wasn't aware there was a mystery. The episode sees the return of the Pyrovile and a fan favourite who appears in cameo, which, I mean, that can only be one of two people, can't it? Number 11, no title. The Doctor's quest to find Gallifrey is over. Number 12, Master and Commander, supposedly. The return of the Master and consequently the Time Lord. Believe the Master is now the president and will be played by esteemed British actor Charles Dance. I personally reckon that this person who compiled this list has been listening to the podcast. What do you think? Largely rubbish, guys? It seems very fannish, doesn't it?
A couple of things that stand out to me are solving the mystery of his latest incarnation by going back to Pompeii, which, first of all, I know that Moffat said that he will address that, which I still think is a mistake. It could turn out to be good, but I still think it's a mistake. I don't think it's something that needs to be addressed. But the fact that, you know, they're going to make the Doctor and Clara realize there's some kind of mystery to who he is for a character that appeared 6 years ago in the TV show.
Yeah.
I just don't see that as really...
No.
I think it's going to be more like a throwaway kind of thing, if anything. And the other thing that gets me is the second episode where it says that they're in the year 3056. It seems lately in the show, they haven't really given exact dates for where they are. And they're just kind of like leaving that to, hey, whatever you want it to be kind of thing. So it just seems a little strange to me that. But a lot of it seems, I mean, I don't know. A lot of it just seems weird.
Well, the whole sort of Sicilius thing is, you know, if that kind of thing was really important, they could have built the Trial of a Time Lord around the fact that the Doctor turned into Maxil, couldn't they? You know, if that kind of thing was really important. And the Trial of a Time Lord did some very, very silly things, but at least they stayed away from that. What do you think, Jim?
I don't think it's. I think it is all just. I think there may be. Yeah, I think there may be some. No, I just don't buy it. It's part of me wants to say, well, yeah, maybe these are some of these names are up for grabs, and maybe fans have speculated. But I don't know the Ghosts of Pompeii. I just can't see it.
No.
I just can't see it. I mean, Moffat has stayed utterly clear of Davis territory, more or less, unless he's been forced to tackle it. And that, fair enough, you know, he's obviously wanted to, as we said before, create his own personality to the universe. I can't see him revisiting another, you know, a one-off story in another. And Pompeii didn't really... The Power of Pompeii, which would probably be a better title, is in the dilemma that is faced with Donna and the Doctor.
I think it's twofold. I think it is that, but also the foreshadowing for what happens later on in the series.
Yeah, well, that's it. But my point being, the actual issues in Pompeii, the monsters, they're not very powerful. They're not something which you'd cry to have come back. They're not something which I can even barely remember.
They're quite striking visually, but they're not. They're also quite forgettable.
Yes, exactly. So
I thought the priestess was much more interesting than the actual soldier that was running around.
Yeah.
So I just don't see a need to go back to Pompeii. And then, of course, you've got the costs as well. I mean, do you have to go and do another overseas?
It's Italy, isn't it?
It just seems a bit fannish, yeah. I think I would like to believe that all of this is utter balderdash.
Or maybe they could film it at that place in Wales. The Mask of Mandragora.
That would be fun.
I will say, though,
Mandragora.
I would actually, the one thing that's on this list that I wouldn't mind seeing is an Egyptian episode.
Yeah.
Like actually set properly in Egypt. I think that would be, well, obviously not filming there, however they can best pull it off, but I think that would be really cool setting.
There is one other thing in there. I mean, I agree with you on that. And there's one other thing I would like to see, and that's I would really like to see Charles Dance as the Master.
Well, I think the Master thing, I think, is definite. I think the Master's coming back.
Right.
From little bits I've heard here, there, and everywhere that, you know, the casting calls for the Master went out. And I think that's, while again, as I say, I've got no evidence to back it up, I think that's probably, there's enough smoke for that fire. Whether it's Charles Dance, I don't know. I bet it isn't. I think there's a lot of, that always seems to happen with Doctor Who. Fans seem to know in advance and are always totally wrong. And it's someone totally, it's the one person they've not really been focusing on. They seem to be quite adept at doing that. So no, I don't think it's
probably
Charles
David
Dance.
Cameron then.
Well, that's it. I mean, I don't know who it would be. I do think the Master probably would be a returning villain. I think that's possibly the only thing. But then, as I say, we've heard those rumours, so it makes sense that someone, if they were going to start trying to justify or plan an episode list, would dot him in at the very end. I'm not even totally sure that, you know, the Master would be an end final character. He could just happen to be a which would be quite fair, wouldn't it, if he was just a one-off event, you know, say a two-parter mid-season. I don't see why he should suddenly have to appear at the end. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That just, again, smells of fans thinking, you know, having seen that played out through the season three, that naturally they would assume that that would be the way that the Master would have to be dealt with in this season, even though all the other monsters have come back, have never done that. The Daleks haven't had to do the parting of the ways and just appear at the end. They've had, do you know what I mean? It seems like it's got that sort of lack of imagination that fandom has. There we go. We'll find out, won't we?
What about you, Brian?
They
do
have on this list. I'm sorry, what was that?
What do you think about Charles Dance as the Master?
You know, I didn't even know who he was.
Really?
I just had to look him up. I know him by his face now, but I don't know him by name.
Right.
The only thing that I have when I saw him was, it seems like if this is a true actor or even a fan list, it seems that they're going with the theory that, Russell went with. You know, the Doctor is young, so therefore the Master needs to be young. Well, now the Doctor is playing by an older fellow, so now he must be an older enemy. And I don't think they need to do that sort of thing. I'm not going to down the actor. I think I'm sure he'd be an inspired choice. I just think whoever put this list together, or if this guy's really in the running, I think that's a bit of a silly kind of way to be. They don't. Why do they both have to be like a mirror image like that? I don't see that.
Okay.
I am taken by the fact that on this list, though, Clara will meet a familiar face in the first episode, and then on their 10th episode, they're going to meet a fan favorite who appears in cameo. You know, it just seems like this thing is littered with returning people so far.
Yeah. I do like the idea of Charles Dance, I have to say. He was in... here's a Doctor Who link for you. He was the villain in the very first episode of the remade Randall and Hopkirk Deceased. Alongside David Tennant.
I like the way 8.9 is to be announced. They don't know the name, but they do know that it's probably set on a forest world, maybe the River Song episode. I mean, is River Song
being interesting, though?
Has she been definitely confirmed as for the next? I know he said at one point, he'd be tempted. He said he even said that Harkness. Someone said that Harkness was a possible.
Right.
Didn't he sort of make an allusion? So he quite like that, or maybe River Song. I don't know.
Oh, can we do his missing years? Can we just get that out of the way? If we're going to go back to Pompeii, let's get Jack's missing years sorted out.
Well, I'd say that. And I'd say, one of the problems I have with River Song, aside from the extremely long Tumblr article I did on River Song the other week, which I don't know why I did it, but I did, is, as I said in there, the problem I find with River Song is that because they never gave us the moment where the Doctor falls in love with River Song, which, you know, we never get that. By the end of, we assume somewhere within that sort of 200-year period, there was this massive whirlwind affair or love thing, which justifies, in the name of the Doctor, him being a lot more, seeming to be a lot more romantic with her than he was previously. Mm-hmm. But we never got that. And now it would be very hard to have it, because it would be very hard to imagine that happened when he was Capaldi, given the way that it's all working. So, to be honest, I feel he's kind of screwed up River Song, that if she comes back, the whole point of her's being lost, the moment's being lost, where he should have actually dealt with that, and he didn't.
No, I agree. I don't think she should be back. I think she was wrapped up in the name of the Doctor and should stay as such. I think, personally, what I like about her character, and I normally don't like too many things about her character, is that she seems like, for the most part, she is wrapped up in the 11th Doctor's life. She had this one meeting with the 10th Doctor. And then aside from that, her life, all her dealings were with the 11th Doctor. And I kind of like that. Rather than her flittering about through all the different Doctors' lives, it seems interesting that those two were kind of destined to tangle, I guess, a little bit, you know, and I like that concept.
Don't you think it would have been a lot better? And, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight and everything, but if she'd just been less sort of knowing, a bit less camp, and be the permanent companion.
She could have been handled way better, and I've said that before, and I agree with you. Yeah, if she was less in your face, less over the top, and even toned down half the sexual aspects of her, and you know, I really don't care that there's sexual tension or sexual interest, but the fact that, you know, all they do the entire time is, like, I don't know, Google each other like a fan fiction, it's just off-putting. You know, but she can be a cool character. And I've said that before. She has moments where she is interesting, and she has moments where they let her play something real and she shows true emotion. And that's where the character is interesting and good. So I don't know if I'd like to see her as the proper companion. I think I like the character as sort of like almost like a female version of the Doctor, where she's doing her own thing throughout time all over the place. But she's got this connection to him and she wants to be with him at times. But, you know, rather than just go where he goes, she's going to go do her own adventures. And I think that's what's interesting about the character. So I don't think I'd like to see her permanently be there. Popping in and out once in a while was fine, but they just didn't handle the character well enough to make her interesting.
I think that's the problem, because she becomes a superwoman very quickly, and there's never any justification. Again, as I go back to the essay I wrote, one of the issues I have, as we've said before, is it when she addresses the Dalek, and the Dalek... cowers. Now, I had I had my boss point out, you know, that the whole point was to show that the River Song has a danger to her that the Doctor doesn't, which is why the Dalek, it's to show the Dalek cowers under that sort of different sort of approach to that she has. But I still feel that Daleks should know, as soon as you make a Dalek cower, you weaken them.
Yeah.
And if you can only have the Daleks sort of take step backs against the Doctor, you know, when they do, when they get a bit worried, because you've had 50 years of seeing them beaten over and over again, you've got to justify to a degree that they would have a certain fear of him by now. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they are a very stupid race. But you don't have that with River. So to give her that sort of power without giving any reason to justify it weakens the Daleks, and it sort of weakens the Doctor a bit as well. And that, I think, is the problem with River. So I agree with Brian. I have no issue with the romance, and I hate it when people say, oh, it's just because you couldn't cope with the idea of the Doctor being romantically involved. And it's not. It's just the way it was handled. It was almost like she was two characters. You know, you wanted a romantic to explore the romantic notion of a Doctor having to deal with a time-traveling, almost paradox character. And yet at the same time, you wanted to create this kind of superhero counterpart to him. Mm. But you don't have the time to do either. You have, what, 13 episodes a series, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And that's not enough time to do that sort of storyline. It's something you do in a series of books or over 26 episodes as you get in the States.
Yeah, and especially since she's not even in all 13.
Exactly,
you know, explore that over the full series.
Okay. We'll move on then. Away from what may or may not happen in Series 8 and the issue of River Song, or the question of River Song. Colin Baker. I love Colin Baker. We all love Colin Baker. He's come out in favour of the having a female Doctor Who, but he said something really silly at the same time. I'm really uncomfortable with it. Basically, this is at the Radio Times covers party recently, and he said, there should be a female Doctor. It won't happen because they are too timid, but there should be. First female Doctor? Here we go. I will have a sex change and do it. I'm in touch with my feminine side. Yep, it's that easy. It's that easy to have a female Doctor. Who knew? Stephen Moffat, of course, said it didn't feel right to me. I'm not doing voices today. It didn't feel right to me right now. I didn't feel enough people wanted it. Oddly enough, most people were who said they were dead against it, and I know I'll get into trouble for saying this, were women. They were saying, no, don't make him a woman. Well, I don't see why he should get into trouble for saying that. I think one of the major aspects of Doctor Who since it returned was the fact that women like watching Doctor Who, and presumably the vast majority of the ladies watching Doctor Who are watching Doctor Who because they quite like the lead actor. I'm no expert in television production, but I suspect that casting vaguely attractive people in the lead is one of the reasons why shows are successful and why they, you know, attract audiences. Guys, am I wrong?
No, I would agree with that. I mean, I do know female fans who think that there should be a female Doctor, but I also know other female fans who don't think there should be a female Doctor. So I don't know what percentage I could put them at, but I think Moffat's true in his words there that you know, there were a lot of females who didn't want to see the Doctor change into a female, and you know, it's understandable. I can get behind the idea of that. I understand why, but
okay, James.
You know.
No, I don't think there should be. I don't see why, you know, if there is a need for a female Doctor per se, why not have, I know we've already discussed River Song, but a more successful
River Song.
River Song, yeah, someone and do a spin-off or do a character that is.
Yeah.
I don't really see the need to make such massive changes in the same way. I don't, you know, a character is slightly arbitrary, but I just don't know whether it's that arbitrary that you can just suddenly. I know Moffat has been the first one to really push for the idea in the script that he can change sex. I still don't know if that feels right to me. I still don't know if that really, really clicks in my head. And it's nothing about sexism. I'd rather have a strong written female Time Lord.
Yeah.
I just don't see why the Doctor needs to be a girl any more than Wonder Woman needs to be challenged by making her man, or you know, James Bond should become Jane Bond, you know, for, you know, on the assumption that it's just a code name. I don't know. It's a funny thing, isn't it? It's a difficult one because by saying no, you automatically feel like you're being sexist, and in a way. I don't know if you are or not. It's a hard one.
I don't. I think it'd just be stupid.
But why would it be stupid?
Because it's trivializing the whole sexism thing, isn't it? It's just, let's do this. It's nothing more than tokenism. It doesn't address the problem that people feel that there should be. Why do people feel there should be a female doctor? What is at the root of that? That's what we need to address and do something about it. Not just change the character to satisfy, what is pretty much basically just a small group of people and a circular fad, a cyclical fad. It's not going to help anyone in the long term. It's not going to do anything in the long term. And on top of that, there are countless strong roles for female actors on television at the moment, and there has been for years. There's very few strong roles for male actors.
Well, there is an argument that, you know, you almost are sort of undermining the female angle by having to say, well, he could turn into a female and he would be a great female as well. In a sense, it's almost like, in a sense, you could almost argue that you're almost taking from the woman, in a sense, rather than giving to him, because suddenly, you know, the woman becomes a man. And I don't know. It's just, I don't know. It just seems to be too unnecessary when you could have a strong female. I would like to see, and I've not seen one for a long time, I would like to see a female, a good female character in Doctor Who again. And as I've said before, I don't believe River Song's it. I'd like to see one that is divorced from having to feel affections for the Doctor. Doesn't mean she has to be against the Doctor. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see a female companion who doesn't have to be proved that she's as good as the Doctor, and you can actually accept her in her own right, like Barbara Wright, as I've said many times before. A perfect example. There was never any point where she was ever considered to be as powerful or as clever or as equal as the Doctor, but she was a strong character in her own right, and they need some of that, some good female characters. And this also gets me a little annoyed, I was talking about this to my friend the other day. Capaldi, there's a big issue about whether Capaldi's a bit old, and one of the arguments is obviously that Doctor Who has generated over the last 10 years a strong young female audience who like quite a young Doctor, and that is understandable. And it annoys me when fans knock that back and say, I'll get rid of the fangirls. I don't see why. That is a legitimate angle, in the same way that none of those male fans have ever turned around and sort of said, well, maybe we should get rid of our Amy Ponds and our Clara Oswalds, which are all under 30, smart, sassy, good-looking female floor models, as well as, you know, maybe good actresses as well, but that is a key element of it. So it seems interesting that you know, we can have an older Doctor, and that's and the female peer, the female four factor people have to lump it into their someone in their 50s, but we can't have an old female companion because the men wouldn't be able to deal with that. It seems to me as if the men have to have their four factor, so that's acceptable.
Well, that brings us back to what I was saying about River Song, doesn't it? If they'd have made the character a little different, had her as the permanent main companion, just toned her down slightly, made her less what she was, maybe picture somewhere between Sarah Jane and Ramana. You can perhaps you'd have an older actress playing an older companion, and you've got the romance sorted out, because if you're pitching it somewhere between Sarah Jane and Ramana, then you can understand where the romance is going to come from.
Yeah. Well, I still think as I said before, we wrote a song, I think possibly we'd have had more of a connection to her if we'd actually seen where the romance. We were told at the beginning the romance was going to be there, whether we liked it or not. It was in history.
Yes.
She'd already experienced it. So there was no getting out of it. We had to accept that.
Yeah.
But we never got, which you do need in romances, the audience needs to actually be able to connect and enjoy the journey to the romance.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, they don't work. It's why you can see in pilots, when a pilot's going to fail is when they feel they forced a will they won't. They were two characters, don't show any chemistry because they know that the network's going to expect it.
Yeah.
And you can see it doesn't click. You've got to allow the audience to follow it and appreciate it and want the characters to get together. And he never did that. And I think that was a major mistake of his with what he did. It was a nice idea. Take the time traveler's wife, employ it in Doctor Who. In the concept, it's a perfect foil for the Doctor in a romance sense. It's got tragedy in it. It's got time in it. And it's got a fascination in it. But, you know, that didn't happen. And so you're left with this very, in the end, River Song ends up just being a very shallow catchphrase character, which is a shame. And I'm surprised so many people like her, given that that's all she ended up being when her potential.
Well, that seems to be what Moff does. I mean, like, you look at the Three Stooges, as I call them, you know, that's all they are. Jenny Vaster and Strax, they're just like the come in, do their silly catchphrase stuff, and then go away. you know, I'm actually, I'm one of the few people out there, I guess, that's very disappointed that they're going to be in the actual first episode of Capaldi's era. I kind of had hoped they might be a little bit done with, you know, but I agree with you on the whole River Song thing. Like, she was just, she could have been a very interesting character, handled very poorly. And Christian, I can see what you're saying, that if they had wrote her a bit differently, she could have had a lot more interest as a permanent traveling companion. However, at the same time, even that would have downplayed her to me. I think if they had changed her character so she wasn't so over the top in many respects, and still kept her as that traveling, time traveling character of her own in her own right, then you could have had the potential to have what they had with Romana back in the day, which you could have easily done a spin-off series with Romana, like they tried to do with Sarah Jane, because she easily was a good female doctor, you know, without having to take this character who's been male now for 13 different incarnations, or 14, I guess, or no,
15?
Yeah, 13. No, 13. But, well, however you want to count it. But I mean, and then all of a sudden and say, here you go. Here's your strong female doctor character. This way females have a strong female character to latch onto. It is wrong. And I agree with that, because you're basically saying that this guy can be a better female character than half the females we've written. So I think that's a wrong way to go. But I think that writing River properly and keeping her on her own time travel timeline and meeting up with the doctor here or there would have been the correct way to go. Since they've already ruined that, they need to come up with another character, another way. Even, in my mind, if they reintroduce Romana to the fold, to the new characters, because she's already there, she's already strong, and we know that she already left and went had adventures of her own. There is no reason why we can't bring her back and show an audience what an awesome character she is now and show how much she's changed since then. And you could easily do a spin-off series or just keep her as a strong character within the show. And I think that she would have more potential than River Song does, or
who,
did.
Who would you have as Romana?
I don't have anyone that I personally would cast right now. I can't, like, I just personally, it's weird. It's kind of like when I think of the Doctor a lot, it's a character more so than an actor. You know, so I would like to see them bring the character back in. Whoever they get to play it, I would like to see their interpretation. But it's just, I just think the character has a lot of potential. Even if, it, you know, they would have to bring her into the TV show first to introduce the Doctor Who fans to her before going, hey, we're going to do a spinoff series. But kind of like going back to something that James had mentioned with James Bond, you know, making James Bond a female would be a wrong thing. But they did at one point try to make a spinoff series and have their own female agent with Halle Berry. But they failed utterly. And the reason they did is because they did the same thing they did with River Song by forcing her on you and shoving her in your face. Like, personally, I think that's a fine movie. But the problem with that movie is that too much of it was spent clearly trying to set up this spinoff series for her, which is bad, because if you go back to Tomorrow Never Dies with Michelle Yeoh, she was fantastic. Yeah. And I would have easily watched a spinoff series with her, and they didn't cram her down our throats. They just showed what an awesome, strong character she was. So you can do it right in Doctor Who, and you can do it wrong. Well, just like in any medium, rather, in any series. And in James Bond just showed you what to do right and what to do wrong. And what Moffat did with River Song was Halle Berry. All they have to do is bring in the Michelle Yeoh, and they're good. And I think they could do that. It doesn't have to be Romana. I'm just thinking she's already an established character that was very strong and is capable of doing the same things the Doctor is.
I think they need to realize, and the writers need to realize, and I still think this is a massive male problem in writing, is that to write a strong woman doesn't mean that you have, by River Song to me, I know people say she's a strong woman. I say she's the opposite, because to me, she feels like a woman who is written to be strong and thus undermines the fact that women are strong. So she has to be like James Bond. She has to be good at everything. She has to be able to compete with the Doctor. She has to be a rival for the Doctor to be a strong woman. She can't be a strong woman in herself. And that, I think, is always a bit disappointing. I've made this comment a lot of times. Is that it's interesting when you take Davis's era and you take Martha, who wasn't particularly liked by a lot of fans and was actually very doty and soppy over the Doctor. She has a very strong ending, doesn't she? Because she actually rebukes him and says, I'm not coming with you. I've got my, you know, I've got to deal with my parents. I'm not going to go and just wander around the galaxy. And that is a strong character trait. Sure. Donna's a very good one. Donna's the best one in the sense, in the archetype for Doctor Who, because she's got the quippy one-liners, which the show loves to take from the Joss Whedon eras of Buffy and the like, but she uses them to hide her own vulnerabilities and insecurities. She becomes very loud and angry and obnoxious and smart when she's defensive.
Yeah.
And that is a very smart way of doing it. But she becomes a very strong woman because she's very fallible at the same time. She has stuff in her which make her very strong, but she's also, you know, she's underperformed in her life. She's dominated by her mother. She doesn't deal with people very well, and those are her weaknesses. But we have weaknesses, and strong women can have weaknesses, just as strong men can. And that is where the show's got to really, I think, from a point of view of showing young kids as well what strong women are, it needs to start doing that.
Yeah. And take Midnight, okay? You've got three key female characters in there that I'm thinking of at the moment. I'm not thinking of the doctor girl, whatever she was. I'm thinking of Sky. I'm thinking of the hostess. And I'm thinking of Lindsay Coulson's characters, right? Those three females, and I know there's four females in it, but those three females are arguably better drawn than anything we've seen in the Moffat era. And they're only in one episode.
Mm. Well, that's it. I mean, I do think that is a real problem. And he's doing... I tend to feel sometimes it's not actually always necessarily a woman thing. That Moffat's very keen to enjoy one-liners in the same way that Joss Whedon did, but he doesn't seem to really work them within personalities. They just start to dominate, and characters become very two-dimensional as they don't exist in their own right. I mean, I've noticed in Sherlock, you know, there's this big thing now that he has that Sherlock recognises that Watson is as important and as powerful as Sherlock is, because while Sherlock solves crimes, Watson saves their lives, and it's like, no, he doesn't. He doesn't have to. You just because you're not so good at someone or you're not so important in a story does not mean that you are not strong in yourself. And he needs to stop doing that. He needs to back off on some of these characters and say they don't have to prove themselves to be strong characters. They can just be strong characters. Let the actors do that.
Yeah.
Let the actors do it. I mean, like Mark Strickson with Turlough, I think, was we've said before. Fantastic actor, I think. You know, Turlough sometimes didn't have much to go with, and as an actor, he felt he didn't have much to go with. But to the audience, he came across really strong because it was the actor who, the way he delivered it. And that is where you've got to back off and let your actors do the work. And he doesn't. And he didn't in name of the in day, time of the Doctor. I can't even remember what bloody Doctor it is. Time of the Doctor. That whole ending. He needed to back off, shut up, let the actors speak through themselves. And you know, that's something that Davis did very well. And as we say, if you compare the two endings to End of Time to the Time of the Doctor, you'll notice End of Time, there's very little dialogue. He lets the actors speak a hell of a lot in their actual body language, and he needs to
Wouldn't argue with you at all there. Just going back to the sex change comment, it's a little bit what do you think? It's a little trivial, isn't it?
It may have been a silly thing to say, but I think it just shows that, you know, he's all for it, and he's trying to just say, like, hey, one way or the other, it should happen. And, you know, I can't fault the guy for the sentiment, really, but maybe it was just the wrong way to put it.
James, thoughts?
I think he's a man who gets a little excited, and, you know, when he talks, he enjoys talking. He's an interesting man. I think sometimes, you know, you can say things as a joke and they get too into it and they say something which probably I know what he's trying to say. You know, he's just having fun with it. He's saying he'd like to see a female doctor, and hey, you know, I would happily change sex so I could become the female doctor. So saying, hey, I love Doctor Who so much, I'd happily come in, I'd even do that. You know, it's an over the top.
Although at the same time, Colin Baker is a very clever guy, and it just kind of occurs to me now, like, was that his little sly way of saying that the only way a woman would actually be cast is if that woman was previously a man?
I don't think so.
Because, well, I mean, just think about it. Like, there is this whole stigma to it that, you know, there will never be a woman cast because secretly it's a man's role. And, you know, and you know, I am in agreement with you guys that it should just stay a guy. I don't think we need to cross those boundaries because I think there's better ways to get a strong female character. But I just wonder if that was kind of like his little sly, like, yeah, you know, if you're expecting it to happen, that woman has to be a man. You know, I think it should happen, but the only way that it probably will be is that. And I don't know, I wouldn't put it past him since he is a witty guy like that, but it could just be like you guys were saying, he's overexcited, but it does make you wonder a little bit.
Mm. Okay, well, I'm slightly distracted because I just found my copy of Alan Moore's writing for comics, which is I thought I'd lost. So that's good. Let's just carry on as we have done for the last 13. And let's do something about female characters in Dot 2 instead of changing the lead character. And again, it makes me think maybe the time has come for a change at the top. But then again, we put a lot of things onto Stephen Moffat, but we must not forget that he's not and hasn't been at any point the only executive producer on that programme.
No. Well, I mean, I don't think, I mean, as we said before, I think there's a lot of stuff that Davis institutionalised, which he's borrowed from. And I think even Davis himself should have backed off and done a few changes. And I think there's been as I said before, I think one of the problems with Doctor Who is, you know, Terence Dix used to say that the companion was always there just to say, well, what's going on here, Doctor? And that's it. And that's, you know, and it can become very, they can become very nothing. And in his world, that's what sort of happened. That was a problem they faced. In this world, where the problem they face, I think, is that if they have a non-contemporary companion who is not of a demographic age, which is going to suit the majority of the audience, they are concerned that they're going to have to actually start writing a hell of a lot more for that companion. Because as soon as you have someone who's not of our age, because, I mean, there's that
our age?
Well, I was talking about our contemporary age.
You're talking eras, right. Okay,
the 21st century. There's an argument. There's been a very strong argument. It's been used for a long time. And it's very true that science fiction is not a reflection of the future. It's a reflection of contemporary situations in an exaggerated proportions. You watch something set in the future in Doctor Who, it has to remind you of issues that are today to be relevant to your understandings of today. If everything was truly futuristic, it would be so bizarre you wouldn't be able to connect to it. And on that logic, that's why the companion stays contemporary, because it makes it very easy. Because if the audience is going to understand what's going on in this futuristic scenario, the companion does. So you don't need to explain anything to the companion. The companion doesn't ever feel totally out of water because we're not. And that becomes a very lazy way to write, because it means you don't ever have to worry about what the companion's thinking, especially if she's a rough backpacker wandering the universe with no other aim than to see things. Yeah, you know, you're going around the universe, you're not trying to get home, you've got no complaints about where you're going to go because you just want to experience. So again, they become horrendously easy to write for because they don't have to question anything other than what the audience will question. And then you fall into the Terence Dix trap, where they become something predictable and boring. And yeah, I think Moffat should have by now escaped that mold which Davis started. And I don't think it's needed anymore. First series, sure, you need it to get people into Doctor Who. Second series, maybe, because you're getting to your international market. Eighth, really? Anyway, there we go. Sorry. We've had some quite lowbrow topics today, so I thought it'd be good to sort of try and bolster them up a bit with something a little more, little more depth to them. Make them a chunky pie.
Good for you. A chunky pie. What about a steampunk pie?
Oh, well, I know. Ain't that the best?
Over the last few weeks, we've seen a few steampunk TARDIS builds, the designs appear. And I dare say there's some CG builds out there. James is probably the expert there.
Yes, there are some fantastic ones.
Yeah. Okay. So rather than actually look at those and talk about them, because
we did that
last week, etc. I'm going to think about Doctor Who and steampunk in general and how the two have intermingled over the years. Now, obviously, we talked about the Fourth Doctor's TARDIS secondary control room.
We did.
Last week.
Yeah.
And much has been said about the Eighth Doctor and his Jules Verne. But are there any other steampunk elements to Doctor Who? Is steampunk really new to Doctor Who?
I suppose you could throw the cyber shades in there from the next
Doctor. Yeah, of course. Yeah,
the next Doctor.
Yeah.
With their
brass faceplates.
Yeah,
or bronze, and in some ways as well, you could probably take the Cushing movies as well. with their very valvey.
Yes, true.
TARDIS interior.
Do you think the Tennant Eccleston TARDIS interior could count, since it's a bit of like hodgepodge Earth devices with all the brass, well, copper kind of thing? I know it's not like full on steampunk look, but you know they do take the kind of
basics of it.
Yeah.
I mean Ed Thomas is kind of renowned as a bit of a magpie in those kind of areas, isn't he? So, and there's, I suppose as well, there's also the Matt Smith original console as well, isn't there? With
taps,
keyboard, typewriter thing going on.
Yeah, the same basic theme. Yeah,
but if one is, then the other one's definitely. Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
I suppose the argument with steampunk is there's a feeling that the Doctor obviously owes a lot to H.G. Wells, and there's a feeling that there's a certain trite simplicity in over-focusing on that. And I think also the other problem is you lose a little of, as we've said this on the podcast before, we've been doing this now for what, 2-3 years? We're going to go over the same ground.
This is season three. Or volume three, whichever you want to look at it. Edition 52. It all changes next week.
Well, that's it. And it's just, I don't know. I actually have lost my thread now.
Okay, you were saying that we've been doing this for a long time. We've maybe talked about it before.
Yes, I was going to say. Yeah, I know. I remember now. It's the beauty of the TARDIS in its stark simplicity before was is it gave a certain amount of isolation to the Doctor that even within his own ship, he is his own thing. He is apart from everything. He's not at home. He's a wanderer, and his own ship doesn't even reflect him particularly. As soon as you go down the steampunk role, you're almost making it as if it is his home, that he does have a place. He's not a traveller. That is his home, which I know a lot of people would argue, well, it is meant to be his home. He even says it in several episodes. But it takes him a little out of water, so I think it hits too close to the bone.
My daughter calls the TARDIS the Doctor's house.
Well, that's it. And a lot of times it is. Even at the end, that lovely little quote at the end of the Seventh Doctor, tea's going cold, the TARDIS is Ace's home, it's the Doctor's home. Doesn't mean it isn't his home, but you want to feel that he's a man who is constantly transitory, that he's constantly not found his place, which is the whole point, maybe arguably, of Day of the Doctor. So,
well, and you could look at it as it's just the most advanced mobile home. Even though it may be technically a home, the place where he sleeps at night, it's not the place he calls home. He didn't uproot and stay somewhere and call this town, this city, or this planet his home. So, yeah, I mean, technically the use of the term home doesn't have to encompass that he's found where he wants to live the rest of his life.
Well, what about if we move away from the TARDIS itself and look at some other elements, such as what about the Fourth Doctor's Burgundy outfit?
What, the Season 18 outfit?
Yeah.
You think that's steampunk? Well,
is it?
I would say more so I forget which episode this actually originally debuted in, but the Robots of Death outfit has a bit more steampunk look to me, with that coat and the neckerchief and that kind of look with the collar than the Season 18 does to me.
Okay. Steampunk, according to Wikipedia, was first termed in 1987.
Really? So soon?
Now, I'm interested to ask, because obviously there's a lot of Art Nouveau to Ropes of Death as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's steer clear of that for now. What about... you've got the control mechanisms in the Towns of Wang Chang for start off, which are kind of, you've got the old concept of the cabinet, then you've got the little control mechanisms. Although it's obviously very futuristic technology, it's been styled to look Victorian, hasn't it?
I just remember the cabinet and the crystal for that to open it, rather. Yeah. I can't a shame.
There's a few other switches in the dungeon, isn't there, under the theatre?
No. Although you're making me remember another episode, and I keep getting flashes of it, like a very Victorian style kind of looking piece of equipment.
Was it ghost lights?
Although there is technically there is that one Christmas episode with Matt Smith. The Snowman?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, of the steampunk era, I guess, the equipment that had the great intelligence.
Yeah, I was coming
it.
To that as well, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the entire gist of the topic was there's a lot of steampunk in Doctor Who beyond, artists, wonderful artists doing outstanding TARDIS interior and exterior designs.
Well, I mean, with a show that's lasted this long, they're going to tread on many a territory. And steampunk does lend itself well to some very nice visuals sets or prop pieces and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I while there have been, I would expect to see more in the future, too. It's just to me, it's just something that's going to happen because it does, especially when you put yourself in situations like the Cybermen in the Next Doctor trying to fix themselves with pieces from that era or. You know, I know we were leaving the console room out of it, but, you know, with the Ninth Doctor fixing up his console room with Earth pieces of equipment, you're always going to get that kind of hodgepodge kind of look. I think it's a nice look. I think it's good that it's used sparingly. This way it doesn't become just the basic and the norm. And it is a nice deviation from times from the gleaming white console bits, which or spaceships even, which I like to see as well. And I think that's one of the best things about Doctor Who is that they don't sit there and go, this is our style, and stay with that style. You know, they're constantly all over the board with the style for the different stories that they have to tell. And I like that. And I like that they've crossed other elements that weren't even steampunk or even what we typically know as technology. And I think that's great that they can think outside the box a lot of times.
Okay. We'll move on from that. We'll do recommendations in a moment. I want to kind of have another rant about the Doctor Who figurine collection, if that's okay with you, dear listener. We are 13 issues through, plus a special. So far, the Emperor Dalek, the Dalek Emperor from the Parting of the Ways hasn't turned up, although he should have been here like 2 months ago. That's a common problem. And issue 14 features the 2013 Cybermen. We've already had a 2006 Cyberman. In the entire run of 14 issues so far, there is one figure that predates 2005, and that is a Supreme Dalek from the Dalek's Master Plan. And the paint job on that was poor. Today, I received issues 12 and 13. We have Dalek Supreme from Journey's End, Stolen Earth, and Ood Sigma from Planet of the Ood, or any of the other appearances that he makes. Now, previously, I had complained that the non-humanoid characters were better painted than the humanoid characters. An Ood is obviously a humanoid character, and it's got a very detailed face. I have to say, I'll come to that in a moment, the Dalek, Supreme Dalek, is, on initial glance, it's okay. But on close inspection, there are various problems with it. His eye stalk was pushed to the left slightly when I... and it pulls out quite easily. So that hadn't been set correctly. And the lamps are slightly out. Bad painting on the lamps. The old hemispheres are generally okay, but the real problems are around the grill, really. That's a bit sloppy up at the grill sort of point. So I'm disappointed with that. However, Ood Sigma is absolutely superb. It's quite possibly the best painted piece that I've received. There is not a single flaw on it.
But does anyone really want Ood Sigma?
Well, that's the question.
You know, I also wonder, too, for every one that you get that isn't painted well versus every one you get that is painted well, I wonder how many people at home at their collections have characters that were really messed up of yours but painted perfectly.
I found a small problem on Ood Sigma, but it's very minor. It's a good point, Brian. I've raised it on Twitter, and I know that I'm not the only person who hasn't received the Dalek Emperor yet. And I know also from previous discussions via email with people that there have been some really bad, like the original, the Davies era, no, I think it was Davros that was in the first issue. Some of the Davroses are absolutely horrendous. I think I mentioned that last time.
Excuse me.
They've used a lacquer on his eyes, and on one of the ones I saw, the lacquer, this is Davros's eyes, and this, to make them like slightly shiny, which gives them kind of a, I'm not sure why, but it kind of, the effect is good. And the one I saw in the shop, basically there was too much lacquer on his eyes, so it was all bubbled up and looked horrendous. I mean, he's ugly to start with, but you don't want to make him more ugly than he is, do you? So, Doctor Who figurine collection, still could do better, basically. And do you know, I'm doubtful at the moment whether they're actually going to reach the end of their run. Because so if they're you know, they're bunging up with the they're essentially let me just have a quick count through. 1, 2, 3. There are 3 so far out of 14, out of 13 issues so far. Next week, the next issue will be 4 characters that originate in the Matt Smith era. 1 in the classic era. I suppose Bronze Dalek, we're going to say Eccleston era. The rest of them are from the Tennant era. Now, yes, he is arguably the most popular Doctor of the modern era. But if you're going to bunch in all of the Tennant stuff early on, what's going to happen later on? Surely you're going to spread it out better so people have got more to look forward to and alternate with your classic era and your modern era. If you're going to stick all the Tennant era stuff at the early stages of the magazine, it's going to die a death when it gets to, you know, doing the Cryons or whatever, you know? So, oh, it just seems so many bad decisions have been made on that magazine.
That's a funny one, that, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's my rant over this week. If you, dear listener, have been buying Doctor Who Figurine Collection or have given up buying Doctor Who Figurine Collection, do let us know in the comments under the podcast. And that brings us to recommendations. I think we all know what I'm going to be talking about this week, so I'll let one of you two guys start.
I will say about the Figurine Collection, okay, when you sure get that Emperor, I would very much like to hear about it because no one's ever made it yet.
Yeah,
like not even the toy line has made it, which is something I wanted just to complete, like my Russell T. Davis era Dalek collection. So it'll be too small for that, but I'm very curious to see how it comes out. But I guess while I'm talking, I will go on and do recommendations.
Go on, do your recommendation.
Since I did that, I really honestly I haven't watched anything new lately. I got in the mood to watch Farscape again. And so I'm going through Farscape season 1, and I would highly recommend it. And, you know, I usually say to people that Farscape really kicks off closer toward the end of season 1 and then never stops running. But I have to say I've really been enjoying going through the entire first season again. I had a completely different thought of what it was like in my head from my memory of it. But it's a great series, and one thing that has always struck me about it is that ever since Doctor Who came back on our screens, is that I really think that Moya, the ship, the living ship, was the inspiration for Russell wanting the TARDIS to be more of a organic feel and living kind of ship. And I know they've hinted at it being living before, but with the fact that it was organic now, with the coral and the brass and the copper and so on, it's pretty much Moya. And the fact that, you know, it's got this consciousness, but within the Farscape show, the ship can't talk to you itself. It talks to you through the pilot of the ship. I've always felt there was some kind of, he kind of saw that element and said, ooh, I like that, and borrowed it. But there's great characters in this show, and they're played very well. They're very well written, and it's different from lots of other science fiction shows in the respect that most of those shows get people together and they say, these people are, they're a team. They work together, or they are friends and they want to do these things together. This show is a bunch of people who don't really want to be where they are and are thrust together, and you get to watch them become a family and become friends. And it's a much more interesting take than seeing everybody always be so happy-go-lucky. Like here, everybody kind of can get on each other's nerves or at each other's throats if they want to. But it's a very, very, very good series.
Okay. I couldn't argue with that. It's a long time since I've seen it. So, James?
No, I don't actually have anything this week, I'm afraid. I've been reading the last of the Life on Mars quartet of Kindle books, which is possibly the nearest. That's it. I keep meaning to go back to The Big Finish. I haven't had time. I know you said you Colony in Space was one that you watched this week, and you were very happy with it, weren't you? I saw that on your Facebook update. Faceache.
What's that, sorry?
Colony in Space was one I noticed that you said that you really liked this week. And yes. I've got Mind of Evil sitting on my shelf, which is my next one, I think.
Right. Okay.
Similar sort of era.
Yes.
And similar sort of classic Classic one. So, yeah, I think I might delve into that this week.
I think you should. I just want to apologise. I was stuck on mute again. So, yes, Colony in Space turned out to be absolutely fantastic. What I did, dear listener, if you're a regular, you'll probably know that I purchased a collection of seven classic Doctor Who DVDs, which I hadn't either never seen or hadn't seen since they were first on, or hadn't seen since UK Gold times. And I think I'd probably seen about two episodes of Colony in Space, both of which were without the Master, so I didn't really know what was going on with that. And I can't, you know, with the green monsters, I'd always kind of pictured it a bit sort of well, crawl-ish. And it's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? My expectations were set a little bit low from having that previous expectation from it, but I was absolutely the Colony itself is really well done. I think some of the acting is a little bit typical for the age, a bit, little bit too RP, etc. You know, the old BBC English with particularly Ash, but on the whole, and the IMC crew are absolutely fantastic, all of them. They're like really nasty. There's Tony Corner in there as well, who was in the EastEnders about 20 years ago as a major character whose name completely escapes me. And you've got also the guy whose name was Bernard Kay as well, mm-hmm. who turned up in loads of shows over the years. He's one of those British character actors who just appears in any TV show he can. He's in a particularly good Professionals as well. And just the whole world is well realised. The IMC crew are really nasty. And, you know, as I said, my previous relationship with this had been sort of two episodes on Gold, and the Doctor Who, one of my key reference books for the classic era of Doctor Who, which seems to have gone missing. The Jean-Marc Lefissier companion book, which you know, outlines things, and the Universal Data Bank. So I had expectations about it, but it's nowhere near. I'd maybe confused some of it with one of the Peladons as well, because mm-hmm. There's a similar kind of ruse going on, isn't there, with the fake monsters.
Yeah.
So I'd also for some reason I thought it was entirely studio bound. So to find them getting out near the quarry pit was good as well, but no, great.
The book's very good as well. I remember that was one of the first Doctor Who Target books I read, was Malcolm Hulk's Doomsday Machine, as it's called.
I think I had that in the... Yes, that was in my local library.
And it was a... Yes, it was same here. And it was a really enjoyable read. But I had to say, I'd read that when I was about 11. So I couldn't really remember much of it at all. But it is brilliant. One of the things I do quite like about it, a very tiny thing, is at the very beginning when the TARDIS lands, they say in the commentary, the guy, the director... wasn't actually aware of how TARDISes could land, and it just appears. There's no fade when it lands, and it just and it's actually really quite effective. I quite like it. It's quite in your face, just a thud, and it's there.
Yeah, it's been retconned, hasn't it? As the Time Lords controlling the TARDIS.
Yeah, they always do things like that. I'm looking forward to the retcon on the whole thing with the TARDIS. Well, maybe he left the stabilizer brake off this one time, eh? That's how it should land.
You know, but one thing I always found interesting about the TARDIS landing in the show was, you know, it was different quite a lot of times, but there were one or two Hartnell stories where it just faded in without a sound.
Yeah.
And it always said to me, so this whole thing with leaving the parking brake on, which I think is an absolutely ridiculous idea, but equally, I think having the Master and the Rani's TARDIS use the same sound effect as the Doctor's, kind of sad, because one thing I always thought the TARDISes should have been was silent. You know, the whole point of the Time Lords was they didn't really get involved, you know, and their ships could blend in to hide. So you, if you think, you know, if a tree is just going to all of a sudden appear out of nowhere, you're not really going to want to advertise with a sound as well as a visual.
Well, it's the perception filter aspect of it as well, haven't you? And some people notice the TARDIS and other people don't they, the sound of it.
Yeah. To me, it sounded like the Doctor's TARDIS, as they always said, you know, it was just kind of on the fritz. And I liked the fact that his had that sound because it was broken. You know,
you're the only person I've ever heard say on the fritz in real life.
Oh, really?
It's always in comics. Do carry on.
I'm glad
Sorry.
To be the first. no, it's just, I mean, it's not the case, because obviously they have since made many TARDISes make that same sound. And therefore, the, you know, Moffat's thing with the parking brake just doesn't work anyway, even when he did it, because they've already, that means that every Time Lord doesn't know how to fly a TARDIS, you know, so whatever, it's just, it's a silly point. But I always just like that idea. I like the fact that, you know, much like the TARDIS's chameleon circuit broke down, you know, whatever was with his engines, you know, maybe his muffler was broken off as well, you know, and you just don't know. And maybe sometimes it was fine, because I just liked it. For instance, it's the Keys of Marinus is one of the ones where it just shows up. There's no sound. And I find that interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the problem is a lot of the books and a lot of the, you know, canon books that followed the series, there was always a suggestion that it was actually the sound of the time opening up, the vortex opening.
Oh yeah,
it breaking into our world as such made that sound. So it wasn't anything that really could be done about it, because that was just.
Yeah.
And but yeah, I know what you mean. I do quite like it when in the early ones. I mean, it's something that I didn't realise for a long time, and I think we've again said this before. But the actual materialising sound didn't actually occur till really late on, as an actual different sound to the dematerialising through pretty much all of Hartnell. Whenever they use it, it is pretty much a dematerializing sound when it appears rather than a materializing one. And you don't actually get that proper reversal, which it is all it is. It's just the same sound reversed for the materialization until a lot later, until that becomes staple. And so, yeah, in those early ones, it's either soundless or the dematerialization sound. Mm. But then, you know, that's it. It's a complex machine. Maybe they all do handbrake turns. Maybe that's what it's like. You know, it's
that's
like
the spinning's
revving.
That's what it's doing at the time.
That's what all the TARDISes do. All the Time Lords love to rake up some dust.
No, that's what he's doing at the beginning of the Eccleston Tennant era titles.
Yes.
That bullet time moment. That's a handbrake turn there.
Yes, there is a bit of a turn, isn't there? Yes. No, it's I don't know. I mean, can you justify the handbrake? Is it canon now that there is a handbrake? I mean, maybe a handbrake is involved in it. And
I can't look at it this way. As Russell T. Davis had said, you know, the Doctor in the show, you have John Pertwee say he's thousands of years old. You have Patrick Troughton say that he can live forever, barring accidents. And then you get one story where they say that he has 13 lives and that's it. And it's stuck. It's one thing that's stuck. But then you try and write other things like what happened with those first two? Why did those first two not stick? But the one with Tom Baker did stick. You know, so I personally think the handbrake thing is, you know, the only way that you can really look at that is River poking fun at the Doctor and having a little bit of fun with him, because there's too many instances. Otherwise, every Time Lord ever that's flown a TARDIS is an idiot and leaves the handbrake on.
The problem with that, of course, is that these days Doctor Who's on a lot more often with repeats and DVDs, so people are going to remember more.
Well, that, you know, that's the other sad thing is that there's one other thing that really kind of bugs me about the new series, and Moffat's era does this a lot more, but Russell's era did it too. I don't know about you guys, but on Facebook and the internet, I am tired already of seeing kidneys everywhere.
I haven't seen it. Souffle
girl.
Oh, see, I've seen that.
You know, yeah. All of those things. You know, all of those little you know, the snog box. You know, any little thing that is said, it gets latched onto. So I really don't think the handbrake thing is going to go away. But for my money, it's a joke. You know, it's already been established in the show that that's just the sound that these ships make, and then to say that they all do it, I think that's too silly. But unfortunately, much like all of these little sayings that are never going to go away, it's not going to go away, I guess, you know. But okay. Right, that's me being an old man.
Yes, you old fogey, you. Well, may that bring us to the end of this week's Castorbis podcast with a kid. I just do have one thing to talk about with you, dear listener, not with James O'Brien, but with you. We're looking for a theme tune. An arrangement of a quite well-known theme tune that would be used on the Castorbis podcast with a K on a regular sort of weekly or bi-weekly, depending on whether we do extras or videos or, you know, occasional reaction casts. And, you know, we've had a few different theme tunes. We've had the house band playing their very cool Lazy Blues number. And, you know, we've used the Doctor Key. Last week, we used the Peter Howell arrangement as a closing titles and a closing theme tune. And we'll probably do the same thing again when one of my two colleagues nominates a favoured Doctor Who theme tune arrangement.
Peter Howell.
Moment's time. We did that last week. We're not doing it again.
Oh, you just asked. And Peter Howell. What about you, Brian? I tend to think your favourite is Peter Howell's as well, isn't it?
Yeah, we did do a podcast on this once before. Well, it's kind of, it's the one that brings the most memory to me.
So maybe we'll finish with that one again, or maybe we won't. But dear listener, there are there are thousands of you now, so we're pretty sure one of you might have a nice arrangement that we can use and would be happy for us to use, with a little link back to you at the bottom of the podcast show notes and all that gubbins there, so you work in there, get a bit of exposure via us, if you are that way inclined. So do let us know, either by tweeting us at CastOrbis DW, emailing me christian@castorbis.com, or dropping us a line through Facebook, or through the website itself. As we run out of contact options there, I can't run out of contact options, it's the 21st century. It's impossible to run out of contact options these days. But that does bring us to the end of this week's CastOrbis podcast with a K. Thank you for listening to us. Thank you, James. Thank you, Brian. And now it's a favoured Doctor Who theme tune. It'll probably be
McCoy. It's the one with the rubber bands, isn't it?
I'm going to do that now.
Please do. Thank you.